Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Dustin Pindell, Bob Weber, and Bob Larson. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Happy to have everybody here today. And on today's show, we're going to talk about some updates from some conferences we've been to, some of the things we learned as we traveled around and talked to others and some of you. We're also going to touch on pasture management. And this is something we often don't think about in mid-August, but we're going to think about planning for the fall. As a sideline to that, we'll address creep feeding and what we should do with those calves. And we'll wrap up with some discussion on BQA and some other topics that are in the news. Before we jump into those, I wanted to talk to you guys because it doesn't seem like fall yet based on the weather, but many of the kids went back to school today, so everybody's getting into that fall mode.
Yeah, definitely. It is. It's not cool yet. It's not the cool season of fall, but it's starting to be school and football and some other changes associated with kind of the end of summer.
Yep, no, I mean, first day of school, at least for my kids, and I think they were calling for the high of 84 today, and I was like, man, it's pretty nice.
I can remember when I was a kid, back before air conditioning.
And you had to walk to school barefoot.
Oh,
and
yeah, uphill.
Both ways, chased by bears.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start out and ask, and several of us have traveled to different conferences. Bob, you went to NCBA. Tell us, what did you learn there that may be beneficial to our listeners?
Well, there was a number of good meetings and committee meetings that I went to. One that I thought was interesting was I went to a meeting where they had a panel discussion from some of the state veterinarians. So these would be people in charge, you know, from each state that were that are in charge of the animal health regulations and enforcement and education in their state. And they were specifically talking about brucellosis vaccinations, brucellosis or Bang's vaccination of heifers. And their point was really the need to kind of modernize some of those rules and some of the ways we use brucellosis vaccination. In that when I was younger and first in practice, brucellosis was still a disease that we did see occasionally in different parts of the United States. And pretty much now it is totally confined to the wildlife in the greater Yellowstone area, occasionally comes into some of the cattle herd that are in direct contact with those wildlife populations. But the regulations and the way that the rules are written for how to handle the cattle vaccination and cattle movement have not changed and kept up to date with that kind of changing and decreasing risk. And so these were state, and one of the ways I thought about it was interesting was these are state animal health officials who you would think would be the most conservative, the most concerned about this disease and wanting to kind of be the most error on the side of caution. And they were really saying it's time to modernize these and kind of loosen some of the...
But it changes over time as the prevalence. And brucellosis or Bang's is the one that the veterinarian administers. The
right. And you
young
the
heifers, you put the orange metal clip tag in there.
Clip tag in, yeah. And so there's more to the topic than I want to cover today. But basically, we haven't modernized and really looked at the regulations associated with that and the movement of cattle across state lines because of brucellosis. And they were saying it's time to look at those and modernize those. And in this case, modernization may be kind of loosening some of those rules.
Excellent. And I think that's a good point and always good to be involved in those discussions and thinking about the next steps. Dustin, you hosted the Animal Health and Economics Conference that was here a couple weeks ago. What were some of the big key takeaways from there?
So yeah, we had, I guess it'd be the third annual ISASA, which stands for the International Society for Economics and Social Sciences of Animal Health, here in the United States, in Atlanta, back late July. And we held that in conjunction with our professional Ag Econ Association meetings. And from there, we had a number of speakers actually from all over the world come present. We had three main themes, which were very interesting. One was on biosecurity and traceability, and one of our keynote speakers is our K-State's very own Glenn Tonzer. The second theme was AMR and kind of One Health, and by One Health we were talking...
So AMR is antimicrobial resistance.
Yes, AMR is that One Health, thinking about the human animal linkages, so zoonotic diseases, I guess. And the third theme was kind of animal behavior, or human behavior and animal health, animal welfare. So we had some folks talk about consumer perceptions, relate that back to animal welfare, farmers' behavior, and then how that plays out into animal health. And so, like I said, there's a lot of folks from all over the world presented on topics.
Would you say that there's a lot of similarities across the, you know, the things you were hearing as far as production systems concerns, a lot of similarities or a lot of differences or a little bit of both?
I would say probably more similarities than comparing U.S. To the rest of the world. Yeah, there's a lot of similar issues, same concerns. It wasn't just what we're seeing here in the United States. I mean, it's same thing. Maybe they're heightened in other parts of the world. Definitely other diseases that maybe we aren't focused on. We had people talk about foot and mouth disease in some of the Eastern European countries, that, or ASF as another example. But definitely similar diseases. I mean, thinking about AMR, I mean, there are concerns all over the world.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting because some of the conferences that I've been at recently, that we're addressing more the people behavior. So whoever's administering and what are some of the things that are driving that, and not just in animal ag, but even on the human side. They talk about some of the differences that drive that decision to use antimicrobials or not. And those are important. One of the conferences I went to recently was they have every 5 years, there's a bovine respiratory disease symposium, which gathers researchers, people from different areas, corporate world, government, and a lot of private practitioners that talk about what are the changes, what have we seen in BRD, what are some of the new things that have come out. And there were a couple speakers that presented on, and we talked about both BRD in dairy cattle and beef cattle. And I guess I'd ask you guys, when you look back, and some of them had numbers to show, you look back over the last 10, 15 years, what has the prevalence or the risk for BRD done? Gone up, gone down, stayed the same?
I would say it's stayed the same or gone up slightly. It's certainly, in my opinion, but again, that kind of depends on the cases that you see on a day-to-day basis. I wouldn't say that we're winning the war against respiratory disease in cattle.
I'd say it's probably about stay the same.
I'd say up slightly.
Yeah. So depending on, all of you are right.
Excellent.
Depending on which numbers you looked at. So if you looked at the number of sick cattle nationally, that's actually gone up a little bit. You look at the number of cattle that died from BRD, a little harder to get some of those numbers, but it looks like it stayed about the same. So depending on which metric you look at, which is surprising, especially as you look back over the last 15, 20 years, we've had a lot of new antimicrobials. We've had good vaccines. We've got good products to help with this disease.
I'd hope better management.
And better management. I think that's one of the key parts, though, is it is a syndrome that's not going to be solved by a syringe and needle.
Right.
That will help us with the process, but we've got to put all the pieces together.
Any sense on sort of, we know that, you know, calf weaning strategies and calves in a feed yard are where we see most of the cases of BRD, but have we made improvements in sort of the pre-weaning incidence of BRD sort of on farm stuff?
That's an interesting question. And this is where, so
I'm just curious we've been at this for a long time. Have we actually made any headway
on the cow calf farm? We don't have as good a numbers. So pre-weaning BRD affects about 1 in 5 cow-calf farms. So it is different than if you have a large feed yard, BRD affects every feed yard. On cow-calf farms, it affects about 1 in 5. So it's very clustered. And it varies even within farm over time. So some farms have a big problem with it. Other farms have zero. But we don't have a good feel for how is that pre-weaning BRD incidence changed over time.
Well, here, I want to throw out maybe a comparison to some human diseases that we think about. So we were just earlier in this podcast, we were talking about brucellosis. So there's a disease that, again, I'm old enough that when I was younger, we still saw that disease. It still caused some problems. And before that, it was a pretty serious disease. And we have made tremendous strides to almost eliminate that disease from the United States. Whereas things like bovine respiratory disease, we haven't made a lot of progress. There are some similarities on the human side. You know, again, when I'm old enough that I can remember, not really active cases of polio, but I remember people that had the syndrome of polio, and we had eliminated that from the planet. Influenza, the common cold, we haven't made any progress in my lifetime. And so it's important to recognize that different diseases are easier or harder to control no matter what species you're talking about. And respiratory disease is one that's going to be hard to control. That
doesn't mean we shouldn't, multifactorial.
Yeah, it's not that we shouldn't attack it. We should, just like human influenza and the cold and stuff. We should be working on it, but we probably won't see the same level of success that we saw with brucellosis on the cattle side or polio that we saw on the human side. We're probably not going to see that level of success. So I think you have to have a realistic expectation, and it's probably going to be a battle that we're going to be in the rest of my career and probably the next generation's career for sure.
Well, managing a single pathogen very different than managing a syndrome.
Yeah. So those are both good examples.
And then even as you look at influenza, it's not really a single pathogen because it continues to mutate that virus.
Yeah. Well, and in BRD, you've got the whole viral sort of stuff to set up the secondary bacterial infection. Well, and so
you've got environment, you got dust,
temporal and dust, and
viruses, bacteria, so a lot of things impacting it. So it's going to be a slow process. And again, so in some ways you can say, gosh, we should have made more progress in 20 years, and maybe so, but this is going to be a slow progress, not a fast progress type of a problem.
Well, I think in the genetics world, there's been lots of optimism about selecting for improved health status. And, well, BRDs, I think, a really complicated one because the phenotype is so imprecise, right? Okay, I either got BRD or I didn't. Well, where was the breakdown in immune status or immune response to vaccination, or was it stress load?
The disease is, the slower the progress is going to make, even with modern tools like genomics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. And I think one of the things that came out of this conference is it addressed some of the genetics, some of the diagnosis, talks some about microbiome. Those conference notes and proceedings and seminars will all be available. They're not out yet, but we'll let you know when those are available.
Cool.
And we can post a link to that. One of the things we wanted to discuss today, so it's mid-August. A lot of times we think about pasture management early in the year. What should I be thinking about now? And let's make an assumption. Cow-calf operation, I've got spring calving cows. They're out on grass. Anything I should be looking for now or aware of as we come into early fall?
Well, I think one of the key things is just sort of looking into the fall, just condition of your pastures in terms of forage availability. We've had, here in East Central Kansas, a really good summer for warm season grass.
But there are places in Kansas and places in the surrounding states where
not so lucky,
not quite so lucky.
Yeah,
although there's a lot of green in a lot of the country right now.
Quality quantity issues. So
when you say assess it, what do you tell me what you do?
Well, I think there's a variety of assessment tools, but the gross one is drive by and look and see if it's still, if you've got a lot of it standing out there, and if it's green, right, that's a good sign.
If
you can see their hooves, bad sign.
Yeah.
That's the sort of the gross mechanism. There's certainly more sophisticated ways to go about a grazing wedge and forage availability. But I think, the key thing this time of year is, looking at my warm season grass, do I have enough of that to get through kind of early fall and into winter? Do I need to think about, utilizing some regrowth? I know in this part of the world, brome that was put up for hay, some potential opportunities to either regraze that or second cutting of brome hay. We talked fescue before the show. Maybe letting that go and stockpile if you've got some fescue, use that for some winter grazing. Cow body condition's a good indicator, though, and monitoring that closely.
Yeah, and
for changes over time.
There's a lag in cow body condition. So if you're running out of grass now, the cows could still be in great condition.
Right.
But they're going to drop off. So you have to look at the grass.
Yeah, that interaction for sure.
One of the things I'd throw out that I have tried to train myself to do but have not been really successful at is, because I do the drive-by look, is there enough grass or not? But even taking a yardstick or some way to measure it and write that down, and I did it pretty well this spring, so it's nice to, and especially it's easy when the grass is growing and you're always happy with what you end up with. But it's also a good way to build that record set. And one of the things you talked about is that lets us compare year to year.
Yeah.
Where am I this year versus last year to help me plan?
Well, there's a lot of things that that really come down to implementation. So I've been to some grazing schools. I know that you guys have too as well. And one of the, one of the tricks that they teach us is to basically walk the pasture. And so every 10 steps or so, stick your yardstick down and just measure. And then write down an average for the time of year and the year. And so I can compare both within this year, how much forage is out there, and compare it to previous years. And that's, you know, I wish I had that all the time, but in order to have that information, I have to take the effort to actually go out and collect that information.
So one of my cheaters' ways of doing it is I take a fair number of pictures. And so if you take a picture, you've got an idea. It doesn't give you as precise a measurement as if I actually measured it. But you take a picture and you're like, oh, this is what it was like last year,
and that's
this
not,
year.
That's not a bad system at all, in my opinion, and just kind of have a file where you, as long as I can go find last year's pictures easily.
I do have a, it's called my phone. So they're all in one file.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's easy, but there you go.
So let's say our grass is short, and we know it is in some parts of the country. And one of the things that I wanted to address, a lot of times so the grass gets short, cows get a little thin. I'm not ready to wean the calves yet. I've got a couple months before I want to wean the calves. And let's say I'm planning on weaning late October, early November. Calves were born in the spring. I'm thinking about creep feeding. And I want to ask Bob, and then Dustin, if you want to throw in on the econ side, but should I creep feed my calves or not? Commercial cow-calf herd, going to sell them at weaning.
A solid maybe.
I lean towards no. I'll kind of say that there might be some situations where I might want to creep feed, but I'm not a very big fan of creep feeding for long periods of time, you know, as in from now or even, you know, the 1st of September, middle
of September.
But
the calves will weigh more.
Yes, they will weigh more, but the feed efficiency and the cost of feed, and the cost of feed includes delivery and loss to wildlife and loss to wind and weather and things like that. When I include all those costs, when I've done the spreadsheets, I've not been happy with the performance. So the way, commonly producers approach me about this, it is in situations when forage is limiting and they want to kind of spare the cows, spare the pasture, those kinds of things. And my personal...
But it works to achieve those.
It does. But I think a better way to achieve that is actually to wean the calves. So if you're really short on forage, these calves are old enough, they could be weaned, and then I can use the same feed that I was going to use as a creep feed, but actually use that in a more controlled setting where I lose less to weather. The calves, I can basically put them in a place where, whether they're using much forage or not, I can control that so much better by weaning the calves and managing them directly than kind of managing them at the same time I'm trying to manage the cows and stuff. So that's why I say I'm not a very big fan of creep feeding, because there's not very many situations where I think it really is the best situation. It's not that it's not a better than others, but it's not the best.
The best. Yeah. Well, I think there's you know, I come at it really from an economic perspective. If the time window allows you to get enough gain, we can pretty easily figure out what you need to do is figure out not the difference in the price of calves, but the marginal difference in the value of calves between, and I did a little quick math this morning. You know, if I anticipate my calf weaning weights are going to be 485 without creep, and I figure, well, I've got 90 days, I can put an additional pound of gain on those calves by creep feeding them, which is a reasonable number. That means they're going to weigh 585. I went looked up in Salina and found those two weight classes. Groups of animals sold, the heavy calves sold for 170 last week, the lighter calves 180. So there's a $10 slide. That came out to a marginal value per pound of 122. Okay, so that tells me if my cost of gain for each additional pound of that 100 I put on is less than $1.22, I make money creep feeding. Well, then what you do is you go figure out Bob's number, how much it's going to cost. The break even's roughly about $230 a ton for the delivered cost of feed, including shrink. So that's not very expensive feed. I don't know. I haven't priced high quality kind of creep feed rations recently. I would be surprised if you could get it done for that, because corn's going to price in at what, 140, 150 a ton straight away anyway. So that's one of the real challenges.
So do the math on your operation. And I think, Bob, one of your point, and I like the, because you're talking about value of that gain, mm-hmm. right? So it's not every pound, but it's just the difference in pounds and how much would it cost me to put on those extra pounds. And Bob, I'll let you respond to it. Is that the right way to be thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right way to think about it. And
so we should creep feed. You're gonna change. He has changed your mind with this spreadsheet. Is that what you're saying?
No, he hasn't. It's just that when I've done that spreadsheet, it's been very rare that I really wanted to pull the trigger and do creep feeding.
Well, it still could be. So there's still the difference. And one of the things you talked about was feed conversion, right? Mm-hmm. So I could. It may be actually cost effective to creep feed, is what you're saying, and I agree, Bob.
Maybe.
However. What you're saying may still be true is if it was cost effective to creep feed, it may be even more cost effective if I wean them and feed them.
Yeah. And maybe that's where I'm really coming from is I'm not comparing it to doing nothing. I'm comparing it to other management that I could do. And in my hands, with my spreadsheets, it's rarely been the best way to handle it.
So do the math before you implement that. Know your costs and get an estimate on the value of your gain. And as you plan for this fall, that leads us to our BCI Cattle Chat checklist today is on late summer nutritional planning. We've got our top five things that we want you to consider as you're planning for the winter nutrition program.
Yeah, I think number five is weaning time. So as we think this time of year, most of us haven't probably given a lot of thought to weaning other than whatever our traditional weaning plan is. But weaning time should be influenced by forage availability and cow body condition score through this time of year to adjust that to help minimize cow costs through winter and optimize calf value.
All right. Number four is consider testing your hay. This is the time of year most of the hay has already been harvested. Grab a forage sample, get an idea of what the quality of your stored forage is.
Number three, evaluate the standing forage you've got and look at sort of how you might optimally graze that through the fall and early winter as a forage source. We know that grazed forage is less expensive than harvested forage. So understand your availability there and how you might strategically use those products if you've got some warm season grass or some cool season grass to regraze.
Number two, start thinking about your winter supplement plan. So after I figured out what my hay looks like and what forage I have available, I want to think about that winter supplement plan before I get too far into winter.
And number one, we want to think about, I want to plan ahead for the costs of the feed with feed costs roughly 35 to 40% of total costs. We want to plan ahead and think about what those, not only the quantity, but what the cost of that feed will be.
Excellent. And that's our BCI Cattle Chat checklist that covers the late summer nutrition planning. One of the things that we wanted to talk about today was beef quality assurance programs. And I just want to touch on this because there's a couple good conferences coming up that will address this. But beef quality assurance is a program that any producer can and should go through to be sure that we're doing things correctly, because that makes a difference in not just what we do, but how we do it. And Bob, you said there's a conference coming up here in Manhattan, actually.
There is, and a couple of things. I guess I would just say, and I want to really encourage all beef producers, if you're not BQA certified, you should be. And there's several ways to do it. You can go online and get certified that way. You can go to a face-to-face meeting. There are meetings all over the state, all over the country. And I think that's important. The BQA program has been around for a couple of decades now, and it's really put together a good set of learning materials that we all need to be reminded about. So I'm going to, first of all, just pitch, if you're not BQA certified and you're a cattle producer, you really should be. The other thing is we're going to make it really convenient because there's a nice two-day meeting here in Manhattan, September 20th and 21st, and we'll link on the show notes to that link so you can register if you'd like to. But it includes a number of topics, include animal handling, as well as kind of some of the BQA, beef quality assurance topics that are really important for producers. So we encourage you to at least consider coming to Manhattan September 20th and 21st, or look for other opportunities to become BQA certified.
And you can do it online.
And you can do it online.
Excellent. We've got a couple other topics that we wanted to address in the news, and one of them was beef trade with the European Union.
Yeah, so that was, I guess, not too terribly long ago in the news. I believe what it was getting additional access to the European Union.
Yeah, it looked markets. Like at least maybe have, at least on paper.
Well, that's just it. I mean, I don't think they've officially signed, at least the EU Parliament signed off on it, that I'm aware of. But the idea was, allowing more allowing us to ship more non-hormone
treated. Yeah, but it still has to be. They haven't changed their policy about cattle treated with growth implants.
Right, and I think what we're doing is, you know, over 7 years, they're going to allow us to import. I think we're currently 18,500 metric tons up to 35,000 metric tons. USMEF, I believe, or actually the United States Trade Representative estimated that'll be roughly $140 to $200 million in additional beef sales.
So at least a potential positive. It's not a negative item.
Correct. No, it's, but again, we'll see it when it happens.
See if it materializes. And it still has the same restrictions relative to hormones, some of the other things. So
I think what it's doing is just allowing us to, increasing that quota, and those we can import more.
Yeah. Along those lines, we talk about beef marketing, and anybody that sells cattle pays a dollar to the beef checkoff, and the beef checkoff fund goes to promoting beef. And Bob, you were actually when you were at NCBA, they talked about the benefits of that dollar that you put forward.
Yeah, and so one of the things that it's hard to put a true value on things like advertising, promotion, interacting with the public. But a group tried their best to kind of put a value on that. And not surprisingly, there is a value, and a positive value in that. And again, certainly you can't hardly imagine a situation where if I work on promotion and I work on educating the consumer and I work with dietitians and others about the benefits of beef, that would be negative. The question is often, how positive is it? Is it at least worth more than the dollar a head that I'm giving? And the answer from the research, and they did a pretty good job. It's a difficult question, so you throw rocks at it a little bit. But basically, they were saying, yeah, there's still a lot of value, upwards of over $10 for every dollar you spend, value that's coming back to the prices we receive as feeder cattle as well as fed cattle.
So we should feel good about that. It's really an investment when you pay that dollar, because some of us you say, well, I got to pay that checkoff dollar. But it's actually an investment, and it's a good investment.
And it's a good investment. And I
so won't a 10-to-1 ROI, everybody be.
Yeah.
And I won't necessarily receive, it doesn't appear that I receive a direct check, but actually I am. Because what this research is saying is if we weren't doing that, the checks you receive at the sale barn and from the final purchaser would not be as high.
Would be less, absolutely. Last topic we were going to update, and we talked last time about there was the fire at the Holcomb plant for Tyson, the packing plant. Don't have a lot of updates at this point, other than we know it's going to take a fair bit of time for that to repair, and that's had some effect on the market. So hopefully more information will be coming out of there soon.
I suppose one of the I shouldn't say encouraging things, but the packer margins are pretty high right now, so there's a lot of motivation for packers to keep into the slaughter. And so there's a pretty good demand for beef products. And so I think there's going to be a pretty substantial local effect as cattle get redistributed to other, either other packers or other Tyson facilities, but there's some pull through to help support that.
So we're Tyson and the other packers, because of this reduced capacity, are making some good money. So there's some reasons to maybe extend shifts and go into Saturday kills
and help keep us pretty current in the fed cattle market. So if prices were low and demand lagging, you could see everybody really backing off on the kill and not absorbing that extra product into the stream, and that would really affect prices. So
absolutely. Well, we appreciate you joining us today. As always, if you have questions, comments, things you'd like us to talk about on the show, send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.